Off the ball on News Talk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.
All right, we've got a very special Saturday panel for you this afternoon. Last Friday, myself and Kevin Kilbane went down to Kilkenny to spend an hour in the company of Martin O'Neill. It's part of our build-up to the Off the Ball Roadshow with Carlsberg, proud sponsors of Irish football, which takes place in Vicar Street next Wednesday. You can get tickets for free on newstalk.com/OTB Vicar Street. Chris Waddle, Kevin Kilbane and Keith Andrews will be among our guests. Here now is our hour-long interview with Martin O'Neill.
You ain't shit!
I wish I was 50 years younger and I'd kick your ass.
Well, fans can be the harshest critics, you know.
And they often are.
A wife is often the harshest critic of her husband.
I thought I was invincible. That's what you're trained to believe as a sports person.
There was 4 million people in Ireland who knew much more about managing football teams than I did. When it comes to music, I can spoof it the best.
Your sporting career is the best time you'll have, and you know, you have to hang on to it for as long as your life, because everything else is pretty crappy.
And this is not light. Stephen Rothschild has never spoken to Jimmy McGuinness in his life.
All right, I'm delighted to say we've got Martin O'Neill with us. Martin, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Pleasure, thank you.
We were just chatting a little bit earlier on with Kevin and wondering when was the first time he'd ever met Martin O'Neill. And he's got a reasonably good story about this, actually.
Kevin's told me about it.
Yeah. Has he?
Yeah.
Okay.
I couldn't wait to tell him the first time I'd actually got to speak to him. But it was, yeah, and I spoke to him about it, and he didn't remember this probably spotty-faced young kid, but I was 16 at Preston at the time, and I was the one entrusted with looking after the away teams when they used to come to the AstroTurf pitch at Deepdale, because we were playing on the plastic pitch in those days. 93, it would have been 93-94 season. Martin was manager of Wickham, and I had to go in, clean the dressing rooms, make the pot of tea and things like this. So the team went out to train and went out to warm up and do the usual stuff.
This was the night before the game would take place.
The night before.
So we had travelled up because it was a plastic pitch, and Preston were generally up to all sorts of tricks. Then it was the idea to go up and practice in the plastic pitch. So we would have been there. That was an evening. So for Kevin to be there and entrusted with those things, that was bit unusual for a young lad.
Yeah, well, I would have had to go in and make a pot of tea, and usually John Beck used to tell me to put half a bag of sugar in or something like that, sweeten them up and things like this before the game. So that's what I would have had to do going in there, yeah. But yeah, I was saying, Martin, then the team went out to warm up and get himself ready. Martin came down and just introduced himself and spoke to us for me and another lad, John Callaghan, two Irish boys actually, me and another lad, both Preston-born lads. But he spoke to us for half an hour, 45 minutes, and just asked about everything, where our families are from and what we wanted to get out of the game and all these sort of things. And it did mean everything to us when we were both 16, yeah.
That's very nice of you to say so, Kev. Thank you. It just shows you I must have been a really nice lad then in those days. I do remember it. Obviously, I didn't know it was Kev that I was speaking to at the time, but I do remember speaking to a couple of young lads in the Preston dressing room, you know.
Because they were Irish, because they were...
Yeah, once they mentioned that the fact that they had they were Irish connected as well too. Yeah, absolutely.
Why?
Well, it's. I think it's always... do you know what? I think that when I came over to Nottingham Forest away back in 1971, there were two Irish lads playing for Nottingham Forest at the time. Liam O'Kean had played for Derry City and had been over there for a couple of years and was doing very well, and a lad called Tommy Jackson who played for Everton, Nottingham Forest, and then later on in his career was actually signed by Tommy Docherty at Manchester United. So I always felt that, as you know, if there was some little Irish connection around it, you would feel just a little bit safer and that you would be able to grow into the company. It never actually worked out for me like that, but anyway, but I always remembered it, and I thought it was just interesting to see young lads trying to make the grade, and you know, with all the hopes and aspirations that a young apprentice would have.
You came over to Nottingham, as you mentioned there. You were already an adult in some ways. I mean, obviously, you're still quite young, but you didn't come alone. Your parents moved and your younger siblings moved as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you can call, I was 19 years of age, so if you can call that being an adult, and I think you're right. I think that there was there were thoughts then at that time in football, that that if you hadn't number one, if you hadn't moved across the water, as they said, by the time that you were 19, that it was probably too late to become a professional footballer. And so I was studying law at Queen's University at the time and playing part-time football for a distillery. This opportunity came along for me to go and play, and Nottingham Forest had made this bid. I wanted to do it and was ready to go. And so I headed over. But my parents, obviously very, very concerned about me. I was slightly less so. I wanted to enjoy life as a professional player. I wanted to have all the trappings that went with this. You know, supposed to be loads of women around Nottingham at the time. And I wanted all of that, and I wanted to be the next George Best, and my parents came over rather quickly. Eventually, they were there in about 2 or 3 months. But for that 2 or 3 months, that was a really enjoyable time. And I'm painting a rather bad picture here, but my parents came over, and actually it worked out fine. You know, my mother looked after me very well, and as you said, siblings joined as well too. So we stayed pretty close as a family.
I think Nottingham has a ratio of 2 women to every 1 man, doesn't it? So I think
How
did you know that?
That's always been relayed back to me, Joe. That has, yeah.
It was fabled. It was actually something like 5-1 at that time, and record was still pretty poor. But listen, Nottingham at that time, really, really terrific city, absolutely terrific city, and of course. The team itself was struggling that particular year. They were going to get relegated, and they were going to lose some great players. Peter Cormack went to Liverpool, but the star of the show was a fellow called Ian Storey-Moore, who went to Manchester United. The team disintegrated from a side only 4 years before that, had been in the semi-final of the FA Cup and the runners-up in the league. And but that, you know, a lot of that, while ferocious disappointment had been relegated, I felt that, you know, this is the life. This is what you want to do. And of course, fast forward a couple of years, where Brian Clough came and joined us in January of 75. And if you were to say that that we, myself, John Robertson, Tony Woodcock, Viv Anderson, Ian Boyer, people like this here would be winning European Cup medals about less than 4 or 5 years later. It's just extraordinary.
We're obviously mad keen to ask you about Clough, but before we do, just that whole notion of the family moving over with you, like, it brings a bit of extra pressure. I understand that the political situation in Northern Ireland at the time is difficult, and there's lots of families taking an opportunity to move away, but suddenly it's kind of on your back if whether or not the entire move has been successful or otherwise.
I probably never really viewed it like that there. In fact, it was a good thing, because my family had moved up to Belfast, and while we were in a relatively safe area of Belfast, we felt that, this was, I had a couple of younger brothers and a younger sister, and a sister just slightly older than me. And I was actually, despite what I said there about 5 or 6 minutes ago, I was actually very, very pleased they came over, because suddenly you're out of trouble, you're there, and I suppose you're probably going to be properly looked after, which is what my mother wanted to do. So I never felt that sort of responsibility or sort of pressure. The pressure's on you to try and become a professional player. One, be in the team. Try and play in the big league. It's as simple as that there. And there was trials and tribulations along the way, which there would have been whether your parents had been there or not. I'm sure Kevin has probably experienced all of those particular things. But no, phenomenal experience, fantastic. And things that you would, that seriously, that you wouldn't, you would never change.
Okay, so there was no sense that I'm upholding the entire family's decision to move here. And in fact, it actually sounds like it was a much more positive thing. There was no sense of negativity around that, or no pressure around that.
No. I said to you jokingly there that I was the first time away from home, and no, you're out and you're fending for yourself for a couple of months. And that sort of thing really appealed to me at the time. You know, perhaps in a couple of years' time, I'll just go crazy and realise that that's what my craziness stemmed from. But no, absolutely fine. Not a problem. And they came over, and my younger brother Shane finished his O-levels at St Malachy's College in Belfast, where we'd been, and then he came over and did A-levels in Nottingham. And
you'd moved around a lot. You said your family had moved to Belfast and you'd been in boarding school as well. So mm-hmm. maybe other people who kind of live in one street all their lives, they find the transition to an English city a bit more difficult. But it seems like you settled in pretty quickly.
You know what? The settling in had all to do with football and nothing else. And I have, funnily enough, I've kept a little, I had a diary from in January of 72. And it's the only diary that I've continued for more than 4 days. You know, normally by January the 5th, it's a blank page, yeah. You know. I've got all these great, great thoughts and great and, you know, fantastic Shakespeare, Wordsworth stuff, you know, and you think it's really great. And then by 5th January, there's no pages left. But this one I continued for a couple of months. And honestly, it's, well, it's complete drivel, to tell you the truth. But
what are you writing about?
I was just writing about my experiences at Forest. And it was usually, it's really nice to know at the end of each page, I was blaming everybody but myself for my inability to sustain any sort of proper challenge in the first team. The team was struggling a bit, and of course, at the time when you think that I scored within 3 weeks, I was in the first team. And I scored against West Bromwich Albion in my debut. And a couple of weeks later at Old Trafford against George Best, Bobby Charlton and Dennis Law all playing for Manchester United, that team at that time. I scored on the 4th of December 1971, went past Bobby Charlton. And he was 92 at the time, I think. But went past and scored this goal. And I thought, this is an easy game. Unfortunately, I hit a bad spell. I think it lasted about 4.5 years. But anyway, joking aside, this is what a life. Professional football, it was fantastic. And then, as I said, when one, you want to do as well as you can. Two, you want to win medals. And we won loads when Brian Clough arrived.
When you were writing your diary, is that like a psychological thing from your point of view, like a motivational thing about the things that you were trying to achieve within the game?
That's an interesting point.
Because that's what psychologists would say to write that, wouldn't they? Now, yeah. if anyone's ever seen one of
yeah, honestly, it's really puerile stuff, I must admit. Seriously,
when you finally do this book,
yeah, absolutely, it certainly won't win any Ivor Novello awards anyway. Let me put it this way, but it is interesting. It's interesting, you know. It's almost there's a couple of pages where it's must try harder type thing, you know. Must try harder, must do it. Who was I blaming most of the time? I think it was anybody but myself. Let me put it this way, you know.
But that environment was a lot harsh. It was a lot harder. It was a lot harder to maybe people think about the modern day game now. But it was a lot harder to achieve in that environment when you moved over.
Absolutely, no question about that. No question. Seriously, you getting over there? Okay, got off to the great start. Good, scored a few goals, and I can understand the manager thinking, well, you know, when you're not actually properly physically fit, never mind anything else, to last games. And of course, he needed, with the team struggling, he wanted to be playing more experienced players. I see all that now. I didn't see it at that particular time, but your point is right about making the grade, because if you felt that you could be discarded at 20 years of age. And there wasn't, as if to say, there wasn't this drop through of, you know, there's an under-19 league, an under-21 league, under-23. There was a reserve league. Mm. And by the time, the great notion there was that if you had not made the grade by the time, let's say you hadn't played in the big league by the time that you were 20 years of age, you might as well wrap it up. So whereas here nowadays, there's players playing, and I nearly fall victim to this, or fall into this category where he's only a young lad. He's only 22, hasn't played a game in the big league. He's only 22, but he can still play under 23 football. And sometimes I think it's a bit of a cop out myself. But even so, you're right, it was harsher in those days.
So we've chatted about this, I know, a lot of time. We've got a category where we would have Robbie Brady and Jeff Hendrick would be in our Young Player of the Year mm-hmm. category with the 24, 25 now. Mm-hmm. So that age demographic has changed so much now
very
from lads
so.
Coming in. So yeah. How difficult is that then for you then to try and get your mindset around that then, around the younger players when they're coming into the squad, when they haven't played a lot of football when they're 21, 22 then?
Well, I think it's a wee bit different to... at club level. So in other words, you don't really own the players as you would do if you're a club manager, and I think you would be looking at that a wee bit more closely if that's the case. When I'm picking the squad and the players are coming into the squad, I'm not really judging it with the number of games that they've played somewhere. Robbie Brady's a really fine player, and Jeff Hendrick, and you think, well, these are the players that you're going to be working with. You want to try and improve. What can you do in a couple of days that is going to improve them? But really, I'm not looking at their ages and thinking of the number of games. They've got a bit of international experience in the last couple of years with me as their manager, and I'm hoping that that will stand them in good stead for the very big games. So that's the most important thing. But I take your point entirely that if you were looking at a club level and somebody's only played, 60 games at 25, you know, then you're thinking, well, is this lad ever going to come through? You know, so I'm not talking about Robbie or I'm not talking about Jeff Hendry. I'm just talking it in general.
Were you hard as a kid, as a 19-year-old? Were you, like, was it easy enough for you to make it into that team? And so notwithstanding the stuff of you must try harder and there's that bit of debate about whether or not you're going to make the team early at the end of that first season, as the team goes down, I think you get into the team pretty quickly mm-hmm. the next year and stay there mm-hmm. largely for the... Was it easy for you?
No, I'd like to turn around and say to you here that this, you know, that was really simple. That I was ready for all challenges, and that I was going to succeed. But I can't say that. Even now, I'd like to have thought that you'd like to have a bit more self confidence about yourself. At that time, there were some lads at Nottingham Forest, lads my age here, who were very, very self confident. Very self-confident indeed, and very useless, but they stayed around a wee bit because of that self-confidence, you know. So if I had the same inability as they possessed, and the lack of real serious confidence in self, I wouldn't have survived. But I think that is important to still have that sort of self-belief, but it's. But there are, don't get me wrong, there are trying moments in that time, and there are trying moments even when you think that you're reasonably established, and along comes someone like Brian Clough, and he was trying most of the time.
Yeah, he seems to have had a desire to kind of, certainly from reading third hand accounts of it, a lot of people say that he would have been particularly hard on you. There are some quotes about he thought that you were smarter than him and he wanted to bring you down to his level, that kind of stuff. Were you aware of any of that stuff at the time, that this was like some kind of psychological warfare going on? Or
no, I you know what, I think if you analyse it, and I know this now as a manager myself, it's down to ability, and you can question people's ability. And you know, John Robertson, my old friend, who was to me, in terms of being a top class player for a number of years at Forest, who was the talisman of the side, certainly in terms of outfield play. We had a great goalkeeper in Peter Shilton. Brian Clough and Peter Taylor questioned him for quite some time. So he had to come through that as well too. So this wasn't a case of Brian Clough stepping in the very first day and seeing this and fantastic talent in John Robertson and saying, he's going to be a world-class winger. Absolutely not. So John had to come through those things, and we all had to do the same thing. Tony Woodcock, who ended up playing for Arsenal, England, Cologne, and winning the European Cup with us at Nottingham Forest. Tony Woodcock had when Clough once said to him, he said, they tell me that you're a good player, son, you know, and he said, I can't see it, you know. And he said, where do you want to play? What position? Of course, Brian Clough was adamant that players would, you know, centre forward, because he was a centre forward himself. He was particularly harsh in centre forwards, including a very, very fine player in Peter Withe. But anyway, he said to Tony Woodcock, where do you want to play? And Tony Woodcock said to him, I want to play off the centre forward. He said, there's no such position as off the centre forward. You're either centre forward or you're not. He said, okay, I want to play centre forward. He said, good, okay. And he started off and we played, Tony Woodcock played a couple of games in a competition called the Anglo-Scottish Cup, which we've won, and up at Ayr or Kilmarnock or somewhere like this here, scored a couple of goals and never looked back. So, but Tony still had to prove him. So we all had to prove ourselves. Was he particularly harsh on me? I think I was a bit smart. I used to answer back, which I really probably shouldn't have done. John Robertson used to say to me, just leave it, Martin. Just keep quiet. And I had to say something at some stage or another. And you know what? You know, you learn. You just keep quiet.
Did you ever feel at the time you were being singled out or picked upon?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, one particular time, yeah. Peter Taylor had a real go at me about, and the whole argument developed into farce, absolute farce, because he had said something detrimental anyway, and I said, oh, by the way, you know, I'm playing wide right hand side, I'm doing the work up and down the pitch, and I've still scored 13 goals this season, and then he said. Alan Durbin would have scored 20 goals. Alan, I said, well, go and get him then. And he said, well, I will do. Alan Durbin, by the way, was managing Stoke City at that time, that very, very day that I was having this argument. So it would have been pointless getting Alan Durbin in. And Alan Durbin wouldn't have scored 20 goals in the side, you know. But we had this kind of stupid argument. And I think even Brian Clough intervened and said, Peter, I think you've just been too harsh on the boy. So, you know, I had my days. Yeah.
Did you like him?
Clough?
Yeah.
I had great respect for him, and I realise as a manager he was he was pretty extraordinary.
Is that a no? I didn't like him.
I can't say that I really liked him. I liked him later on, and his family paid me fantastic comment or a compliment by allowing me to speak at his memorial service, you know, three speakers. So, and I think that later on that he grew to like me a little bit better, I think. And I invited him and he came to one of the Leicester City Cup finals that we were involved in. And he sat round the table, and my wife and daughters tell me he was the absolute star, as you would expect him to be. His health was maybe fading a little bit at that time, but he was particularly complimentary later on. But at the time, as a player, you always think it's confrontation. And you know what? I think he thought that I thrived in confrontation, would you? But I think I would rather have had the praise, to tell you the truth, you know. Larry Lloyd used to say that John Robertson and Kenny Burns, who was another favourite of, and I can only do this in radio, that they would get a kind of a thumbs up, and it was in the form of his thumb and forefinger going together almost in a little circle. And if Kenny Burns or John Robertson did anything, he would be up with this little thing. And Larry Lloyd used to say to me, he said, how come, Martin, we never get that little sign? But he did. He gave Larry Lloyd plenty of praise. And when I deserved it, I got the praise as well.
Because there are like specific instances where you remember him saying something nice about you, like halftime in the European Cup final, and you guys are under the cosh. There's a debate about what's going to happen, and you put your hand up to volunteer for something.
Yeah, that's absolutely. That was a really great moment. We were playing against Hamburg in the final, and we had taken the lead. John Robertson scored the goal, and it was great. But we just the last 15 minutes, we were yielding a little bit. And they were having the ball, and we'd lost Trevor Francis a couple of weeks before that there, and young Gary Mills was playing in the side, and Gary Birtles was playing a lone furrow up front, so we were under pressure at the time, and we were just, as I said, they had the likes of Kevin Keegan and about six other German internationals playing for them and strong favourites in the game. And we came in at half time, and there was something he was talking about, moving something around. And I said, I'll do it. He said, no, I'm absolutely perfectly happy where you are, because you are playing brilliantly. And can you imagine the sort of feeling? You couldn't wait to get out for the second half. No, I think I'd played better games in other particular matches, but under that sort of pressure at that time, that was just in the half time of a European Cup final. Actually, nice to hear from the manager.
You know, you mentioned before, you said sometimes he felt as though he could have been perceived as being picked upon and singled out. But did you ever, or any of the other players in that side, have it in your mind, look, I'm going to leave? Or was it always just to always try and show him? Was it always as if you were trying to prove to him you're worth the whole time? Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it could be easy to say, look, I'm sick of this, I want to walk out, I've had enough of this now.
In my case, definitely to prove him wrong, or seemingly to prove him wrong all the time. John Robertson, after a period of time, John became his favourite, and quite rightly so. John was a fantastic player. Things were happening. You get it out to John, and I can imagine as a manager for a Brian Clough, getting it out to John, wide left-hand side. How can you be the fulcrum of the side from wide left-hand side? But John was. And he would mentally relax because John wouldn't give it away. You know, wouldn't give the ball away, where sometimes all of us by under pressure might have been prone to have done something like that. But John, so I can imagine those things. But John had earned that praise. He'd earned it. And he was getting it most times. And I think that John said himself that if John had come in at halftime, Brian Clough knew not to, even if he was playing badly, John wouldn't have received any criticism, because John might not have been able to have handled it as well. And I think he perhaps deep down, I say this to myself, that he maybe thought I could maybe handle it. But definitely in my point, it was to prove him wrong every single time it was, or so I felt that was the case.
And could you handle it? Like, were there times when actually you're riven with doubt, despite the fact that you're captain of Northern Ireland, you're winning European Cups, you've won the league? Like, did it have, was there a toll, was there a price to pay for the fact that sometimes he was digging you out?
Eventually when I left the club after 10 years, I was playing wide right hand side in the team. John McGovern had picked up an injury, so I moved into the middle for a number of weeks. Played really well. We were winning big games, and it was great. And looks as if when John was fit again, John moved into the middle, and then I went wide right hand side. And then a couple of weeks later, I was made sub in a game, and I thought, I'm not having this. I'm really not having this. And so I said to him I wasn't going to turn up for a game. And he said, you better be there. You better be there at this game. It was against Stoke City. And anyway, I didn't come to the game, which I'm ashamed to say. And Brian Clough arrived. Unfortunately, John Robertson phoned me to tell me the house. We didn't have mobiles in those days, but phoned me to tell me, do you want to hear the good news or the bad news? The good news was that the game was called off. The bad news is that Brian Clough travelled from Derby to come over to see if you were in the boat and on the coach. Anyway, suspended me for a couple of weeks, and then brought me back for one reserve game. Then sent me home again. Then sent me, allowed me to go to play in the World Club Championship final, the world game against Forest versus Nacional of Uruguay. First time it was played in Japan. And one game instead of a two-legged affair, and came back, left me at home again for another week, came back, played against, and I think the irony of it all is I came back to play against Stoke, the game that was rescheduled, and then I played against Arsenal on the Saturday. Norwich City were interested in signing me at the time, desperately wanted me to do, and I played on the Saturday, scored twice against Arsenal. We beat Arsenal 3-0 or 3-1. Two goals against Jennings. Won a bent round the corner. That was my last ever game for them. No, he wasn't prepared to change his mind, or I think Taylor wasn't prepared to change his mind about it. And I signed for Norwich the next week after 10 years.
I didn't realise that you hadn't showed up for a game, and that's kind of... And that precipitates this. Why did you decide that you weren't
going to... Because that was it. Because I was playing brilliantly. Or so I thought.
Can I ask you now, as a manager?
Not at all, of course. Absolutely.
If one of your players didn't show up for a game.
Absolutely. Yeah. But it just shows you how much I wanted to play. Yeah. Players now don't turn up for games because they don't want to play. You know, that's the difference. I wanted to play. I wanted to play every single week. and that, and it was. I almost felt it was a shame if you could ever get left out or made sob in that. You know, absolutely, that was the way it was.
Were you pissed off at that? Like getting transferred, because like you're playing really well and you just want to.
Do you know what it was? It was the start of the breakup of the team anyway, because what had happened a couple of months before that. We'd won the European Cup in the previous year. He'd told me I'd played really, really well in the final, which was great. Came back for pre-season. And then we got knocked out, because the European Cup in those days was a knockout affair for immediately. We got knocked out by CSK Sofia, which we should have won by a cricket score. And we got knocked out of that. And I think that Clough decided this was the breaking up of the side. He has said since that he realised now that he shouldn't have done so. The likes of Larry Lloyd, Kenny Burns, myself, we all left. When we had time, Tony Woodcock wasn't even there at the time. So, and that side, although was getting a bit older, it was still, you're talking about lads at 28, 29, you know, who could still have gone on. And I think Clough said some years later, he wish he hadn't have done that.
What did he say to you when he realised you hadn't showed up?
Oh, yeah, well, obviously. He was pretty peeved at that, the very fact that I'd carried it through, and but you know, do you know what? I'm really pleased the game was off, so I never actually missed the match. You know, so at the end of it all, but I wouldn't be advocating that now, and I'd be pretty irritated of any player. But the very fact, but honestly, it was under the circumstances that he could. We had won. Forest were winning a lot of games at the time, so I can't say that was any a new experience. But we were winning games, and I was playing really, really well in the middle of the field, getting, and I was strong. I was actually strong, and even though I never did a weight exercise in my life, I was actually physically strong and hard to shift off the ball, and getting things going. It was great. And then John McGovern comes back, and I move out wide, okay, for couple of games, and then be some. So the last thing, I didn't mind the moving of the wide. It was the substitutions part, but it was really annoying at the time.
Heartbreaking a bit, like you know, yeah, these are the days of your life, and suddenly they're over because you've got to go to Norwich.
No, Norwich. I loved it. It's interesting because at Norwich, the manager and assistant manager thought I couldn't do any wrong. It was great, really good. I got up to play centre midfield, and while the side, it was 2 points for a victory in those days, and I went and they were pretty well bottom of the league. They'd been beaten the previous Friday night 4-0 by Birmingham. And that was the Saturday that I scored the two goals against Arsenal. And if Clough and Taylor had said, listen, you're staying, I would have stayed, you know. But then I thought, well, if I score two goals against Arsenal in the match, and that's from midfield, and they can't see it, then it's nearly about time to go. And the team was, as I said, breaking up. Anyway, at Norwich, I couldn't do any wrong, really. Manager thought I could play, and that's a big thing. And the difference was, of course, Nottingham Forest were at that stage, had spent the last couple of years winning trophies. And eventually, that's what the game's about. Mm. It's about winning. Winning the big games.
Was there an ongoing dialogue with Clough when he's bringing you to Japan and then leaving you out? Or is it like he's kind of glaring at you and not speaking? Or
it's essentially glaring and not speaking. Long bouts of silence. I didn't mind, you know. He shouted once at me to take my hands out of my pockets away back from the top of the stand in Japan once, you know. And I sort of turned my nose up at it, you know. But I, you know what? It was one of those where you felt it was like almost like the beginning of the end, anyway, yeah. You know. But listen, he brought me back for the game.
Do you know when you were left out under Brian Clough? What was it like if you felt as though you said you were playing well? You had to go knock on his door. Then,
yeah.
What did it feel like going and knocking on his door and asking him that question? Why aren't I playing?
Well, I swallowed a number of bravery tablets first of all, and then went and knocked on his door. Yeah, and but when you felt. I think deep down, you know, he had a bit of admiration for that there, because if I felt I was being hard done by. And there's one particular time he could give me no reason for leaving me out, which is, you know, he, who's a bright, bright man, could not be able to even give you, even if he had made it up, I wouldn't have minded it. But he just said, no, okay, I know you're playing well, son, but, you know, this is the way I'm doing it. I thought, well, yeah, that's a decent way. I'll remember that as a manager. Yeah.
How much of that stuff did you use as a manager? How, like, some of it comes in by osmosis. Some of it is conscious. I want this. I'm going to use that. Some of it is I'm definitely not going to do that.
Oh no, I can't for 1 minute say that Brian Clough got everything right. No, not at all. There's some things that he did that you know that I think we all felt wasn't great. But you know what? You know when you're winning, you know it seems to be right. And but as a manager, I think that he would have been the first one to have said, don't be. Be what you are yourself. And that's, it would be an impossible to have worked with that man and not have learned things. Of course you do. But seriously, do not try and copy him. Have your own state of mind.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Be who you are yourself, because I guess we never really know people who are in the public eye the way they are in reality, because obviously you come and you do press conferences and you do media events, and that's part of the job and it's part of the show. And so it's an opportunity for us to ask questions today to get to know you a little bit. How do you define yourself? Who are you? When
I really don't know. I really don't. I haven't had time to define myself. You know. I probably maybe will do just about 10 minutes before I'm laid to rest. You know, by that which time it'll be far too late.
But when Clough is saying you have to be yourself, like for me, it sounds like you like discourse and you like asking people why they're doing stuff and to explain stuff. And if you disagree with it, you feel happy enough to have an argument. And
I don't mind confrontation, to be perfectly honest. Even though I'm not physically big and in the dressing room, it has been at times when you have people like Bobo Baldy or John Hartson or. Shall I say, Chris Sutton, people like this here who are far bigger than you and who are almost physically testing you, and that you, that's, I think that's the time that you realise how unpopular you are as a manager, is when the rest of the players are goading that particular player onto to knocking your block off. But no, I had an argument once with John, and at the end of a game which we won at Celtic, we reached the final of a competition that was played at Hampden, and John was still questioning why I had taken him off. And I think I said to him, you'd have to run around a bit, you know. I think that was the time I said to John, John, get warmed up, you're coming off. But he, listen, Hartson could score a goal for us and pulled me out of many a hole. But no, it's when I think that... I don't mind the confrontation. Seriously, it's not that I don't want to provoke it. You want to think that you have got some sort of reasonably cogent argument for whatever you're saying, but no, but it's still important for the players to hear. And Clough was, of course, a master at it. He was he could, despite the occasional time, the occasional lapse, he could for the most. Speak very simply, but you knew where you stood, you know, absolutely.
Do you feel the need to keep a distance from your players that Clough kept, or does that change? Does that depend on the individual as well?
I think that I'm not. I think that I'm. I can get as close as I want to players. John Robertson and Steve Walford, who were with me for all those years at Leicester City, Celtic, Aston Villa, would really be the ones who would, you know, if the players, I think that the players had great trust in those two, that the fact that they wouldn't be coming back and telling tales unless it was something really serious, that they could put some trust in them. And John, I told John, unless it was very serious, don't bother me with minutiae trivia, I should say. Just get on with it, and I think the players that started really at Leicester continued at Celtic, and the likes of Chris Sutton, Henrik Larsson, all those players could have confided in John and Steve, and that's fine, no problem. But my interest was them winning matches for the team, and obviously it's going to help me.
Is it going to help you? Obviously, the winning match is going to help you, but is that bit of distance, is that so you can, if you feel the need to say a harsh word, say a harsh word? Or is it also because you saw the benefit of the occasional pat on the back as opposed to the constant, you're awesome, this is amazing, everything's great, but we just lost?
Yeah, I think that I think it's everyone to their own. If you want a manager who is as I said, constantly in the eyesight of the players, and earshot, that's fine. If he wants to be their pal, that's good luck to it. You know, it's not me. But it doesn't mean that I can't praise players, of course. That's still very important.
It sounds when you talk about your assistants there as well, they're pretty vital to how you run your ship day to day, whether it be club management, particularly over here, certainly now with the international. Is that how did you choose your assistant then when you were first starting out in club management? What was in your thoughts when you were choosing your assistant?
Well, John, I was when I started out in management, I was applying for jobs down in the lower level. I thought that with the sort of playing record it would have, that at least you would get an interview, which is seemed to be beyond a lot of the lower league clubs. Anyway, I went to manage at Grantham. They were in the Beezer Home Midland Division, which is only about 78 leagues below the Premier League.
How did you get that job, as a matter of interest?
Well, it's because most other people didn't want it, I think, you know. I got the job because one of the directors came over to my house, and Grantham is about 25 miles from Nottingham, and one of the directors came over and asked me would I do the job, and I thought, okay, yeah, I'll have a look at it. And
because you were selling insurance at this point, that was your day job.
I was it was pensioned. I was made manager of an office, and telling people to do something I quite palpably couldn't do myself. So it was pretty good. So it was pensions and such things that gets here. And John Robertson joined me with that. I asked John to play for Grantham, and he played a couple of games now, and that I had. People like Kenny Burns play for me for about 6 and 6 pence per week, and I had Mickey Maguire, little boy called Mickey Maguire. I had Kennedy, who from winning a European Cup medal at Liverpool, played a number of games, and in front of him at the time was the lad that I signed from Lincoln United, called Gary Crosby. And Gary Crosby was a late developer. He played 8 games for us. He won 7 on his own. And we sold him to Nottingham Forest. But I was saying to Alan Kennedy, who was really great, came down, I said, Alan wanted to show how, you know, what he could do. Alan, your job was just to give it out to him and just stay put, you know. Honestly, I know you've won the European Cup and you can show us that any given day, but just give it to him and he'll win the game for us, you know. So off went Crosby to Forest, Clough. So I had that relationship with Clough, so it couldn't have been that bad that he trusted me. I told him that Gary Crosby would definitely make the grade. And he said, are you sure? Honestly, I said that absolutely. He can go past players. He can go either way. And he's got a big heart, and he can definitely play in the big league. And even and Clough said, well, I'll take your word for it, and he did, you know. So I always thought, well, if I don't make it in management, I'll definitely be a decent chief scout somewhere. You know?
the process of picking those and building those relationships with your coaches and the people who you trust, that obviously has to be a relationship that's quite special.
Yeah, well, I've known John a long time. John Roberts and I have got absolute trust in John. John wouldn't be, as I've seen happen in the game, even if John, if he had any disagreement with me, John and I would decide in privacy that that's the case. John would, and I would never expect, I would never have thought that John would have gone out and said something that, you know, let's say, oh, sorry, he, you know, the manager picked the team this week, but I totally disagreed with it.
Yeah.
John would never have done that. A complete trust in it. And not, listen, John Robertson was a very fine player and a really good brain. I knew the game. I knew the game inside out. And also John knows people as well too. So, and John forged a great relationship with a lot of players who have got a lot of time for him.
Do you want him to see the game the same way as you, or do you want him to see the game slightly differently so that you have conversations around a different viewpoint?
No, I'd like to see it whatever way he sees it. Generally speaking, you know, we actually probably see the game in the same way, despite the fact that, you know, where John was a creative player. But John can see the defensive side of things. It's really interesting, you know. And I, for instance, you know, Alan Hansen, who was, I just mentioned him, I think that Alan Hansen, one of the great pundits of the game, you know, and never managed. But he saw the whole game from a managerial viewpoint. And I used to wonder how, you know. But then they had some great managers at Liverpool. Mm. And some of those players, I believe, actually thought in a managerial way, you know. So that is really interesting, you know, considering that he had never managed in the game.
Yeah.
He could see. I used to think that Hansen saw the game from a managerial viewpoint rather than from a playing viewpoint. Really, Donald's play. Do you agree?
No, I probably would, yeah. I think his viewpoint whenever with him was definitely from that sort of...
Wasn't it?
Definitely that sort of viewpoint. Definitely, yeah, it was.
Yeah. So the point I'm trying to make and the correlation with that there was that John, despite being a creative player, could see the defensive side, and I could certainly see the defensive side, even though I would never have played defence.
Do you get frustrated by the way other people then who are in punditry see the game? Like, cause...
No, everyone to their own, absolutely. No, if I totally and utterly disagree with something that somebody's saying, yeah, I'll shout into the TV, but nobody's going to hear me. No.
Is that one of the things that's different about the Ireland job in that?
And there are a couple of woeful pundits out there, you know?
Yeah.
You know, who have actually played the game.
Yeah.
Not talking about the man across the way, but seriously. There are a couple of who shall remain nameless and who are... Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I think you can stop the game at any given second in a screen and tell, you know, that boy should be back in that position. That lad might, as Brian Clough said, might have run 60 yards before that to help out his colleague, as he said, in the game, son, you know, might have just helped out his colleague, and he's making his way back and he's doing his best, and you're isolating him here for saying he's not in the right position.
Yeah,
we can all do that.
Yeah,
you know,
except the thing with the national team is that a lot of the language around it is dictated by the TV punditry. Now, I don't know if The View is necessarily dictated in the way it would have been when we were kids growing up, where there was like no access, no other analysis, no other media around it. It was like the two lads said whatever they said and the public parroted that. Maybe I think now people have much more access and they have their own information and they can make their own mind up. But it's still there's still the dominant viewpoint sometimes is the viewpoint that comes across from the TV punditry. And with the national team, everybody feels a sense of ownership about that.
I'm sorry, I'm not following you. Give me that again.
Are you worried that sometimes the analysis around the national team is a bit too negative?
You could have said that in the first place.
I could.
You could. Yeah, it took you 15 minutes to...
Why did you explain it properly, though? Yeah,
well, it's easier
changed.
If you just speak simply, you know. It helps. I think that... do you know what? I have to say that I probably when I came in first, you know, you get to hear about the things and you think to yourself, well, that's way out. It's kind of ridiculous. Now, seriously, I mean it. It doesn't bother me one jot now. Do you know why? We qualified for France, and that the night that we beat Bosnia was just like fantastic. You know. To me, better night than beating Germany. You know, Germany was a great night, but it was a one-off. You have to finish the job. So Bosnia, well, there was finality about it, and that was really, really great. I've always felt that. And, of course, that encounter in Lille against Italy was fantastic. Brady's goal, really great. So, no, honestly, now... I don't.
You did up until the achievement of qualifying. There was
I tell you what, because you want to qualify, and you know how difficult it is. And it's not to say that Republic of Ireland qualify for every single competition. You know, since inauguration, you know, there's only been a certain number of times, and we've had some very, very fine players, really good players playing who never made it, who never got through. Do you know? So that's the point. So we have what we have in the side, and the players are committed. That commitment itself is, as Kevin will tell you, is not remotely good enough, but it's a start, and we've got this. Players want to play, and you know what? Qualifying is a slog. It's a slog. You play in a tournament. We played against Sweden. I thought it was the best football we had played since, you know, we only drew in the game. We got well and truly beaten against Belgium, and if you look at the players that they have, they're fine. We come roaring back against Italy, and if we'd been given another couple of days rest, I think that we could have maybe have seen the game through against France. That's, you know, that's hypothetical now at the end of the day, and they're a very fine side. But qualification means everything. It's a vindication. It's all of those things. And no, honestly, it doesn't bother me anymore.
Given the success that we had there at the Euros as well, the start of the campaign, going to Serbia then, and then the Georgia games, we face criticism when we've had good results off the back. Maybe some of the performances haven't been great, but good results that a lot of people maybe don't take into account at times.
It made me smile more than anything else. And sometimes you just leave it. We're just on the back of it. We're back at, in the back of a competition. We go to Serbia, and the heavy pitch. If you look at about 7 or 8 of the Serbian players, you know, they're not playing for Barnet. They're not. I promise you. They're playing for Chelsea. They're playing for Manchester City. They're playing in the Bundesliga. They're playing in the top sides. They are very good players. I said from the outset, anybody who finishes in front of Serbia will probably win the group. You know, and that's the and Serbia. And so we've drawn in Serbia. We've scored in the first minute. And I was asked a question at the end of the game. Which I thought was, you know, I thought it was pretty comical. A question that you scored early on in the game. How come you couldn't hold out? You know, what happened? Well, yeah, unfortunately, there was only another 89 minutes to go. And even Barcelona sometimes score in the first minute and don't hold out for games. You know, so, you know what? You get on with it. So in terms of the criticism, I always think that there'll be that around. You'll not be able to do something well enough at the end of it all. But you know what? You know, we're in fighting at this minute. We've we had a few problems against Wales in terms of some major players beforehand, and obviously Seamus Coleman during the course of the game. We'll get up for the Austria game and try and we'll just try and keep going for it. Yeah. It's not easy. It is a slog, as I said, and sometimes that's forgotten. It's even though it's only over a 10 game period, it's actually over a year, and you have to depend on your best players being available and fit.
Over the years, does your mind get frayed by the fact that it's kind of a constant little low drumbeat of tension there? Like, the Euros is great because it's over in 5-6 weeks, and it's kind of somewhat akin to club management's game training. Mm-hmm. This is like, well, when's my next game? Okay, everybody's looking back at that last game.
You do have a break, but when you get in, this is something I have realised, the intensity is greater than anything, because you know that you only, that what happens now in this game, this 90 minutes, you don't have the following Wednesday night to put it right. You don't have, you know, the following Saturday, or you don't have a game in 12 days, or you don't have another cup competition. You don't have any of these things. It's all on that day. And it's what you have at that, and whatever team you have available to you, you have to make the most of that.
And psychologically, do you get to turn off? Can you train your brain to go, okay, I'm not thinking about this game that's coming up until I have to think about it? Or are you constantly going, well, in this scenario, if this player is available, if that player is injured?
No, do you know what? International management doesn't allow you. I don't think that you can. You cannot start planning for something. This is definitely an interesting question you make. You cannot plan for those things until you know what's available for you. You can watch the opposition, and we do so. We have a look and think, well, if that's roughly the side that they're going to have, that's fine. But you cannot be setting out certain particular plans until you know who you have. and you wait around for that. And it's impossible. We've lost Seamus Coleman for a start. We've lost Shane Long now on this side. You know, David Myler, a few people like it. We've got James McCarthy. We've got a few problems. So until the lads gather, you can't really, really plan. What you can do, although players at club level won't, because their mind's totally involved in club football, is that they can't be, even if you wanted to send them little videos, chances are the players won't look at them until they get into the camp. But you will have already done work on the opposition in terms of what they do, set pieces and things like this here, you know. So you will know. So you're just then, you will afford that information to those players then and hope that they can grasp it.
Given that as well, look, can you look back with the results that you've probably got, particularly through this campaign with the injuries that we've had? You say you can't focus on the Wales game. The injury list for that game was extensive. It's going into this Austria game now extensive. So given the results that you've actually achieved with players out, How do you look upon those sort of performances? Do you look at them with more pride than the ones that you've had when you've had a full squad?
Yeah, I think so. I think that that's right. I think that, you're going in, just say that's, for instance, 7 weeks before the Wales game or 8 weeks before the Wales game, you're thinking, go on, this is, you've got everybody available. The next thing you know, Shane Duffy has broken his metatarsal. It starts off with that, then Kieran Clark's out, the people are out, and then suddenly lads who have been playing and have done really well for you in the games, they're going to be missing in the side. Then you get a few problems. And yeah, I think at some stage then, perhaps even though we were at home, not actually getting beaten by Wales, considering they had everyone available to them, was probably okay. Whereas 6 weeks before that, you're thinking, you know, we can win the game. But I don't think you should be negative about it. I think, whatever comes or goes, whatever's available to us in Austria, we have to be ready for it. You know, you just have to be, and your concentration totally for that week, if not beforehand, is there. So I'm not contradicting myself. And what I'm saying is that I can prepare and think about particular scenarios, but when you really set down to it, it's when you have available to you.
In relation to the spells that you get between games then as well, so you have so much time to think. And one of the constant questions that you seem to have been asked since you've taken over the job, it's about one particular player that hasn't necessarily declared for us. Mm-hmm. And it's such an interesting one for me as well, because people are almost expecting you to be banging on doors, making phone calls to certain players. I'm talking now in relation to Scott Hogan. Mm-hmm. We've had Jack Grealish before. This constant theme of question that's come your way. Yeah. So, what do you think when you get in the, because you go into your press conferences, like anything regarding Scott Hogan or anything regarding Jack Grealish? Yeah. And I mean, I've probably got my own view on it, my own opinion on it, but I just find it interesting that you, what your thoughts on it when you're getting these barraged with these questions constantly.
Well, I think that if you look over, if you think about press conferences in the last 25 years, and Jack Charlton, Mick McCarthy, all the way, the questions will always be about the players that you haven't picked. Mm. You know, about why did they. Why are you not picking that lad who is playing outside left in the Siberian League? Well, actually, I haven't had the chance to see him playing, and he's 36, and didn't make the grade at Shamrock Rovers. So that's, if the people asking the questions actually went and sat down and tried to analyse it before they actually asked the question, they might think it's actually pretty ridiculous. So let's go and concentrate on the players that we have. But to your point about players like Hogan, like Grealish and that, I think that the interesting thing, first of all, there has to be some sort of desire within the player to want to play for a start. Number one, it has to come from within rather than from without. So you can cajole, you can encourage, you can do, and you can certain, and absolutely, I'm sure if you're one-to-one with someone and you thought he was thinking about some things and you thought he was worthwhile to do it, then I think that you should go. And that's exactly what we did with Grealish. Spoke to his father and spoke to Grealish himself on a number of occasions. And they had played at underage level. Jack had played at underage level. But he wanted whoever made the decision, either Jack himself, his father, or the family, That's fine. Mm. That's fine. Once they've made their minds up, that is fine. And you know what? Jack's actually English. And his father's English. It wasn't as if to say I was expecting to hear a Kerry accent when it's playing. You know, he's a Brummie at the end of the day. You know, so he's... And they are... And so he was brought up in England. And Jack's English. So I can understand it. You know, I really
do. But that questioning comes of you, though. There have been... I've read things where it's been said Martin O'Neill hasn't done enough to actually convince him. So what do you think when you see him or hearing that?
You know what? Again, yeah. You know what? You get irritated for about a minute and a half and then you realise who's written it and then you just leave it, you know? And you think, well, what's the point? What's the point? There'll be another day.
I've seen, absolutely.
So
you feel very strongly about this, that there's no way we should ever be actually begging people to play for the country.
No, I don't. I've always felt that.
I agree with you. Absolutely agree. As I said, I'm getting back to the point where you'd want to think that you might have an influence if someone is considering it. And that's the point. And if you've done your very, very best and you think that, and the player chooses to go with another way, that is fine, honestly. I tried, but you have to see some sort of sign that somebody wants to do it.
It seems to me it's almost if you've got to try and sell. It's almost like, you're a club manager. You've got to sell the club to someone. Yeah. That should never be the case. I would ever feel that.
Absolutely agree with you.
And that's where it seems to me it's almost gone. The criticism that comes to you, that you've not done enough.
I'd seen that. I saw the people who'd written it. I have worked with them for the last few years, so no problem.
One last question. You had unbelievable success at Celtic. You hit spectacular highs with Leicester as well. Has this job given you the same satisfaction and on an ongoing basis? Do you love this job as much as those jobs?
I have really enjoyed the job. I must admit that I was a way back. I would not have been sure about international football in that sense. That for all the reasons that we see, you know, the games come intermittently. Then there's the pressure, which you know is on at that stage. And if you've talked to any of the international managers who have managed at club level and internationally, would always feel the same, you know, same sort of pressures, but that you can't rectify it if it's a poor result. As, for instance, in the case that we had against Scotland, away back in November of the qualification stage of the Euros, we lost the game at Celtic Park, and then it's a long time to wait for a game to March. That's long. That is really long, you know, and you're thinking about that there for a long, long time, and you have to listen to the criticism that you take, and you have to do all of those particular things. Then we come back and we draw against Poland, and you haven't won that game. And then we draw against Scotland, and then criticism is there. But I know I've said this before. I knew that was not the end of proceedings. Been too long, and I knew that that Scotland would have a difficult game in Georgia. Also felt that we probably would either have to get a result against Germany or in Poland, if that's the case. But the minute that Georgia game, I felt that we were still in with a chance. Now, talking about that, getting back to your point about the time element, I think that's always the case, and always will be with international managers. Be interesting to see what Conte thinks now. You know, he's gone. He had a spell as Italian manager. Would he have wanted to have left and won the Euros or something like that there? But he's left. He's gone. And he'll have taken great satisfaction out of winning that league then with Chelsea. So you asked me, have I enjoyed the job? I have enjoyed it immensely. Really have. If you'd asked me a way back, the reason I've enjoyed it immensely is because we've qualified for the Euros. That's it. And if I can continue to enjoy it, it will be because we're making a fist of trying to qualify for the World Cup.
That's hard, though. That's like results-driven dictating happiness.
That's it.
That means it's kind of more of a vocation that you feel like you have to be a football manager.
That's been my life. Yeah. That's why my happiness is driven with the results, you know, as you can tell in my family.
Very difficult existence.
Yeah, my
daughter. Are crazy.
I've got a daughter now who is early 30s, but right from a very early age at Wycombe Wanderers, she realised the significance of results at a very early age, and I mean very early. And she realised that a Chinese meal in High Wycombe seemed much, much better if we'd won the game against Starbridge or something like this here. So she used to say to me that last advice, just win. Just win. And then everything is fine.
Brilliant advice from out of the mouths of babes. Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure, Jim. No problem.
Well, that was a really enjoyable hour at Martin O'Neill. It was all part of our build-up to the Off the Wall Roadshow with Carlsberg, proud sponsors of Irish football, which takes place in Vicar Street next Wednesday. You can get tickets for free on newstalk.com/OTB Vicar Street. Chris Waddle, Kevin Kilbane and Keith Andrews are going to be among our guests. If you want to listen back to Martin O'Neill, it's up on newstalk.com right now.
Off the Ball on Newstalk. Thanks to Air. Catch all the sports you love free on the Air Sport Pack with Air Broadband.